Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It's been a while. And rejoining the program after a bit of a hiatus is Grant Newsham. Grant, how are you? Long time no talk.
Yeah, it's been a while. Pretty good.
Where you been? Did you go back to Poland? Where'd you go? What have you been doing?
No, I'm in Japan at the moment, in Tokyo. And was in Hawaii for a little bit just before that. I was in Thailand recently.
Oh. Well, tell us about your adventures. What were you doing in Thailand?
Oh, I got invited to an event, which was, it's always unusual for me to get invited anywhere, so I seem to offend everybody. But I got invited to speak about sort of corporate governance, running a clean company, it's a very interesting event put on by a German organization. Just had a range of sort of interesting perspectives on the topic, and I gave my pitch about how you sort of run a clean company, at least from keeping criminals out of it. So that was my thing. So Goldman Sachs would not invite me to such a conference, I suspect.
Well, it's increasingly more difficult these days to run something clean. I was reading, I saw an article the company's called Dolce Gabbana, high end.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they, yeah. Dolce Gabbana. The Chinese had taken them to task for offending them. Now, what was their offense? They featured.
What was it? They made a. I just have read a little bit about it to get the basics. The company made, which sells high-end luxury clothing and shoes and that sort of stuff, I think. I think shoes is their thing, but it's that one of those stores you would see on Rodeo Drive or such like. But it's very well known. But they made a commercial, and they do a lot of business in China. And they made a commercial, an ad, with apparently with a Chinese woman using chopsticks to eat spaghetti or something like that. And it also had some sort of double entendres in some of the language. And for some reason, some Chinese took offense at this, and I guess it went viral, I guess is what hip people call it. And suddenly the entire nation, or at least those busybodies who get upset about such things, took offense. And in China, since there's a billion plus people, those busybodies is a whole lot of people. And the company, to sort of head off trouble, they issued an apology, I guess, to two top guys, maybe Dolce and Gabbana, I don't know. And it was like one of the... these sort of self-criticism sessions, or the kind of sort of like the prisoners of the North Vietnamese would issue statements. And they were just, the whole thing is so insane that the civilized world doesn't laugh this out of the room, says plenty.
And they don't either. And then I found funny was, okay, less than a year ago, right? Mercedes-Benz apologized for having the unmitigated gall to feature the Dalai Lama on its Instagram account. And so the Chinese extorted an apology from Mercedes-Benz for having the unmitigated gall to use the Dalai Lama on their Instagram account. And that's the kind of shit the Chinese do everywhere. It's amazing.
That's what they do. But in the Dolce & Gabbana case, this abject apology was not considered apology enough.
Yeah.
So they're just as much trouble as they've ever been. I don't know how much more insane anything could be. But someday, I don't know if there ever will be, as long as there's money to be had. I think the white man has proven himself capable of any sort of any humiliation. If there's money, as long as they can cash their check, they'll do anything. They'll do anything with the most awful people, just to make money. But it's a textbook case of how these things work in China, and what I say Westerners in particular will do to keep making money. But there'll be another one. It'll sort of blow over, but then someone else will run afoul of the Chinese busybodies, and these poor guys. One hardly knows what to say. They're also, they do, it's sort of a high-end luxury goods company based in Italy, but they've got Chinese setting up shop in Italy, making their own stuff, calling it Made in Italy, and there's counterfeiting of their stuff going on in these little Italian villages where they make the stuff. So they're really under attack from all directions. By these people who have become the modern equivalent of the Mongol hordes pouring off the eastern steppe in the 13th century to go sack Krakow. But nobody will say anything about it because they think they can make money. Right. And it's something. And I don't know when or how it's going to end.
Well, okay. So let's, on top of that, let's double down on that. Today, or yesterday, Amnesty International announced that it would stage a worldwide protest against what Google's doing in China. And I saw the chairman of Joint Chief of Staff get asked about this at the security forum in, I want to say Nova Scotia, but it's not, in Halifax.
And yeah, Nova Scotia.
Right. So, what they asked him about it without naming Google, of course. And he said, "Well, here's what I don't understand. We're the good guys. We're the good guys around the world. We stand with the free democracies. They don't. And so, these companies, meaning Google, but not saying them, these companies, headquartered here." Because we're the only nation that, the Western democracies are the only nations that protect international content and copyrights, or intellectual content and copyrights. And then they turn their back on us, and they hop in bed, and he said, and know that anything, any technology that you give to your partner in China goes straight to the Chinese military. And what they're designing is a system of, quote, social scores that means they look at what everybody does on their devices, and you're going to be assigned a social score. And when your social score hits a certain number, you're going to get a knock on the door. Or you visit certain websites, you're going to get a knock on the door. It will be an Orwellian type of control that George Orwell could have never even conceived when he wrote the book. And how do you think Amnesty International is going to do with Google? Because that's like, when we talk about liberal organizations, Amnesty International is certainly among them, and now they're even getting after Google.
Well, let's see. I'm glad they are. It's about time that, one, they go after Google. Two, they go after somebody who deserves it. But we'll see just how much traction this sort of thing gets. Apparently, there's some internal opposition within Google at the working level, I suppose. But yes, General Dunford was right. And it's not complicated. He might have mentioned, do the words concentration camps mean anything? to these people at Google? Apparently not. I don't think it matters to a lot of companies, but just Google is the sort of the biggest, latest to prove itself willing to do business with these people. But I asked a guy who I like not too long ago. I said, when is this going to stop? Is it going to take the shooting? Once the shooting stops, will they stop doing business with the PRC? And he said, no, it will take the shooting to start, but then they will stop the business only because banking restrictions prevent them from cashing their checks. And this is what you saw at the beginning of World War II as well. And it's really not anything new. It's just so obvious and brazen that troubles decent people. I'll put it that way.
So are you telling me that Google exists without a soul?
Yes, at a certain level. I think it's that MBA class or the professional CEO class that we've had develop in the last 30 years that has really shown itself willing to do anything for money, regardless of the consequences on individuals. Just go to Southwest Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio, and look what's happened to America's manufacturing industry. That was a conscious choice to put these people out of work in order to increase people's own bonuses and salaries at the managerial class, the CEO class level, these too clever by half MBA types. And that is something, so when people blame globalization for things, they should realize that there's very conscious choices made by sort of the business ruling class that really was willing to sacrifice their own citizens, and also in the name of chasing lower cost labor and one more percentage point in return on investment, and their own bonuses, stock options, etc. It's malicious, I would say, if you look at it. And I think Google just really typifies this. I'm not sure Amazon is much better, but Google's in the hot seat at the moment.
All right. Now I want to triple down. You recently wrote about the chairman of the CEO of Nissan, a guy named Carlos Ghosn. Is that how you say his name?
It's Ghosn.
Ghosn.
Yeah, Carlos Ghosn. Yeah. But I would, when I read it, I say Ghosn as well. Mm. And then when I say it out loud, I think I say it the way he would say it.
All right. Talk to us about what is all that about. We've watched it. What is all that about? Because Japan is its own curious little business event.
Yeah. As near as I can tell, this is what I think is going on. He's the chairman of Nissan and also Mitsubishi, or he's CEO or such like of Mitsubishi and also Renault, as I recall. And around in the late 90s, Nissan, the company that, Datsun, Nissan, everybody knows it, this huge company, it was going bankrupt. It would have gone bankrupt quite possibly. Could have gone the way, say, of American Motors or one of these companies that doesn't exist anymore. It almost went out of business. That's what bad shape it was in. They managed to get Renault, the French company, to save it or to step in and provide financial and other support to it. And Renault sent this fellow named Carlos Ghosn. He's a Lebanese-Brazilian. He's a Frenchman. And he basically saved it. He oversaw the necessary cost-cutting and adjustments that were required to keep Nissan afloat. And Nissan has since done pretty well. It certainly survived, and it's done well. And he... A move from being CEO of Nissan to being chairman, I guess, a year ago or so. He flew, and he, as part of his duties, he flew back to Japan on November 19th, landed at Haneda Airport in his private jet, and the Japanese prosecutors came onto his airplane and basically arrested him. And there's an American who's also the local representative director, and he too got arrested. But Ghosn, he was more collateral damage. Ghosn was the target, and Ghosn was put into what sort of the Japanese equivalent of a Chinese black prison or Abu Ghraib prison in detention, and they put him in for 10 days, and then they've put him in for another 10 days, as the law allows them to do, and then they can rearrest him and keep him in there for a lot of 10-day periods. And so that's what they've done. They just dragged him off and threw him into the slammer. And they announced that what he was arrested for, underreporting his income by something like $40 million over 5 years. That's what the prosecutors arrested him for, announced. The Nissan at the same time announced that they had found evidence of wrongdoing, financial wrongdoing by him, involving company assets. And what has happened actually is that in order to prevent, as near as I can tell, and I think this is what's going on, these are basically, there may be a little bit, I don't think much truth to some of the charges. Maybe, I don't think there's much. But it's being used as a way to destroy him. But in order, one, they don't, people didn't like him in Nissan. Some people did. You know how everyone has enemies everywhere.
Right.
They didn't like him because he was so well paid compared to what they were. He's kind of a high-profile guy. And so Nissan had some people who hated him. So they got the Japanese prosecutors to conspire with them to basically arrest him and destroy him and get him out of the company in order to prevent a complete merger between Renault and Nissan. And Renault has the advantage in any merger because they got some very good terms in late 90s when they took over Nissan. So in order to prevent effectively foreigners from taking over Nissan and effectively to purify the company of the foreigners' taint, Japanese executives and Japanese prosecutors with some level of official government sanction and political sanction have taken a man on trumped-up charges, thrown him into prison, kept him in detention where he is incommunicado, being interrogated for 8 hours a day at least, in order to, as I say, get rid of the white man or the foreigner and the Westerner, put it that way. And it's crazy. It's about as crazy as Google doing business with the PRC, maybe even more so. But it reflects a strain of anti-Westernism that you find in Japan, particularly at the elite class level, combined with just human resentments of him. But it makes Japan look ridiculous. You know, if Ghosn had landed in Beijing or Pyongyang, you could understand something like this. But when one thinks of the Japan they know and have this happen, it's pretty crazy. I was not surprised. Actually, it took me, I was a little surprised at first, and then once you looked into it and once you thought about it a bit and talked to some people, I don't think there's any better explanation for it. But it is just brazen anti-Westernism or xenophobia that one doesn't, most people don't associate with Japan. I would say it generally keeps itself under better control, but that's what's going on. I wrote an article pointing out that this is not the first thing like this that we've seen in Japan over the last 20 years.
Hello.
And that's what's going on. There's a defense ramification to this as well, to my way of thinking.
So,
long explanation.
No. But people that follow it know, right? People that follow it, that like, oh, he got sideways with somebody, right? And this is just the trumped up nonsense that they'll use to run him out. So
pretty much. Yeah. The Chargers are thin gruel, to put it mildly, and especially compared to what it passes for standard behavior, normal behavior in Japan. That's what makes it so funny. Is it anyone who understands the Japanese business world? That was one of my my friends put it. He says, well, the Japanese CEOs and managing directors are really nothing more than hoods, is how he put it, which is kind of true.
He left out well-dressed hoods, though.
They're not all that well-dressed.
Shit.
The suits are kind of off the rack at Zachary All sort of
Come
stuff.
On.
They aren't polite. They are polite seeming. I will put it that way. And the guy, the guy who kicked him out at Nissan and was actually Ghosn's protege, and he held a press conference.
It was like
the Japanese version of Bill Clinton. When he remember how he would bite his lip,
yes,
and then say he didn't do whatever he really did, but got caught at doing. And this guy said, he was a very classic Japanese, very stone-faced, you know, pretending to fight off tears, saying how outraged he was and how they had to get rid of Ghosn because he was evil and get him out of the company. And then, like, a few days later, he has another press conference and says, you know, I think the French were too strong in our joint venture agreement. But it was Bill Clinton biting his lip. But you would, if you were a prosecutor or a trial lawyer, you'd love this, because here's his protege claiming that Ghosn was doing all these bad things, you know, financial misreporting and violating securities laws and, buying, misusing company assets. So this has been the guy's protege for 20 years. So the question is, well, were you complicit or are you incompetent? But what's going to happen here is that this will, as is usually the case in Japan, I don't think that this is going to be properly investigated. Japan doesn't really have investigative reporters. There's just an immense ability of Japan's political class, an official class, to close ranks and give everyone the old Sergeant Schultz, I see nothing, I hear nothing sort of treatment. But where I say this has a defense angle to it is I think the guys, the American commanders in Japan over the years could all appreciate this. Because whenever anything negative happens in the U.S.-Japan relationship, the Japanese government will invariably blame it on the United States. Invariably.
What?
And this requires the Americans to kowtow, to scrape their heads on the floor, apologize for this and that, while they are being berated by Japanese officials and politicians. And that's what they're expected to do.
How do we get blamed for that? Can you walk me through that maze? How this becomes our fault?
I could, I think, but because they can get away with it, they do it, and because we let them do it, we do it. It is this misguided notion that, well, the relationship is so sensitive that if we don't kowtow, there will be mass protests, or who knows, the Japanese might tell us to leave. Well, they might as well go ahead. But it's really, I would say it's our fault, both the military level and our civilian leadership level who handle alliance matters. Instead of showing some backbone, they have shown at least the backbone of sort of a jellyfish. And that's it. Instead of standing up for ourselves. Another thing that I'm hoping to write up, I've been asked to by an outfit. One of the things that Japan is just desperate to do is to get into something called Five Eyes, this relationship, this intelligence collection and sharing relationship with the Americans, the British, the Canadians, the Australians, and the New Zealanders have. And this really is the cool guys, you know, in terms of intelligence gathering and intelligence sharing, the Five Eyes relationship. And Japan desperately wants to get in this. And my argument is, well, why would you let somebody in who really doesn't like Westerners? you know, who knows at what day, you know, someday, or best tolerates them as long as they're kind of necessary. And there's a reason we don't let the Israelis into Five Eyes. Someday Japan decides that, well, the Westerners just don't understand us or our interests. So, well, we're going to cut a little deal with the Russians to get our northern territories back and give them a little information. You know, you cannot let somebody in when you've got doubts about how much they like you. And I don't think I have a feeling the approval to go after Gon took place at a very high level in the Japanese government. I don't know if Abe knew about it or agreed to it, but I don't think they understood the second order effects of all of this. And, you know, you listen to me, and I think you'd call me a friend of Japan, but I'm not very pleased to see what's happened here.
Grant Newsom, our guest, and we're kind of rolling around the dial here, and it seems to be the same show. That look, you can come do business here, okay, under our terms. If you get sideways, we'll find a way to invent something that offends us, and either take you down or do something around the world, and it's just very interesting. The G20 is coming up. What do you think is going to come out of that? We have continued to see the United States and China, you know, both content to disagree over trade. China set a record last quarter with its trade deficit with the United States, so that seems to be boding well in their favor. But President Trump doesn't seem to be in any hurry to let them off the hook, which I think he knows that they're squirming on the hook. But he knows that that hook is uncomfortable for them, but evidently they're not ready to make a deal yet. Your take on the economics confrontation between the two countries, which I think really dwarfs anything militarily, and all the gesticulation that's going on in the South China Sea, that's like, wah, wah, wah. The real action is the economic action. I'd be curious about your thoughts on that and the upcoming G20. Anything going to change?
I hope not. One always worries that somehow almost use the term generically, the Goldman Sachs guys who are in the administration or think they have influence in the administration, which some of them do, will get Mr. Trump to cut a deal of some sort with the Chinese, promising to buy more American stuff, to open up their markets, etc. I'm hoping he does not do that. If he does, and if they announce some sort of deal, the game's just about over with us in China, because we've got them, if not on the mat, we've got them staggering. I hope that it ends without any sort of agreement, but with America saying, well, we're going to increase tariffs. That would be the ideal outcome. And I think it's more likely than not that's going to happen. Because I think within the Trump administration, I think the guys who understand the need to keep the pressure on have the upper hand. You know, as I say, I really hope that's the case. Because one way that I look at this is that, this is where China is vulnerable, is economically. And it's easier to go after a country economically than it is to try and go after them militarily. Certainly in our case, where we've shown ourselves unwillingness to properly improve our defenses, and that's as much a fault of the defense establishments as anyone else's.
Right.
If you can't do it for $700 billion, I don't know what you could do it with. But the way to look at it is that, and to remember, as I may have mentioned before, is that the Chinese government depends on foreign exchange. It has to earn money in order to do whatever it is it wants to do, particularly overseas. So the Belt and Road Initiative, you have to pay for stuff if you want, say, iron ore or copper, whatever it is, anything from overseas, you have to pay for it in convertible currency. the Chinese money, the yuan, is not convertible, which means that it's kind of like Confederate money. You can use it in the country, but overseas, if you want stuff, you have to buy it with Yankee greenbacks or Japanese yen or euros or some, or Swiss francs, a convertible currency that everybody wants, everyone will take it. If you show up with a, you know, say a boatload of Chinese money, nobody's going to want it. So you're going to have to somehow get a convertible currency, which means, kind of means dollars. And that is, nobody quite realizes that. There's a sense that, well, the Chinese government is like the American government. All it has to do is print money and everybody everywhere wants it. But no, the government has to earn money in order to sort of pay for everything it wants to do. And what the tariffs are doing is reducing exports, so reducing the ability of the Chinese government to earn money that they can buy stuff with. Additionally, the restrictions, the heightened restrictions on Chinese investment into America and even into Europe have made it harder for the Chinese to do things which will earn them money. Also, American and Western companies are showing more reluctance about investing in China. And when they invest in China, that gives the government more money to do stuff with. And that so there's been this constant inflow of money into the PRC. So what all these collective actions by the Trump administration are doing have actually reduced the amount of money. It's sort of choked off the amount of convertible exchange that convertible money that the Yankee greenbacks, as Jefferson Davis would have called them, that the Chinese government can use. So for all the So for all these things China wants to do overseas, it doesn't have the money to do it. It's got a case of the shorts, I think they used to say in Brooklyn. And that is really causing them some problems. Additionally, it's causing them some, you know, there's a confidence aspect to all of this. And it's this reduced business activity, reduced exports are causing Chinese companies and factories to close down. The unemployment rate in China is much, much worse than it's reported. It's said to be like 4% by the government, but some people say it's closer to 20%. And once you put the skier in them, once you sort of upset this public confidence, and it does matter even in countries like China, once you do that, then you've really hurt them. And the Trump administration has identified the key Chinese Communist Party vulnerability and is trying to apply pressure on that point. And they deserve some credit for that. And we'll see if they keep the pressure up. And what we would see is if there's no agreement or no agreement to end the trade spat, it's not even a war yet. It's really just applying a little pressure. America hasn't done anything near what it could do. But if the Americans say no deal, we're going to increase tariffs from 10% to 25%, and we're going to put them onto more goods, then that I would consider that a favorable outcome. It would not be the end of the game, but it would mean we're going to continue doing what we're doing. And seeing where that gets us, and then that'll be very interesting to see what happens. You know, China, you know, has $4 trillion or whatever, 3 or 4 trillion in foreign exchange reserves, and that's not much money. They spent $1 trillion a couple of years ago just to prop up their currency and prop up their stock markets when there was a crisis of confidence, and $1 trillion that. Even a few trillion, it doesn't get you very far in China's case. So we'll see how it goes. But that I think is the big thing, is the economic, if there's an agreement reached on the economic end, and I think if there isn't, I think the Chinese will be, you know, the Chinese leadership, they'll be sort of sweating a la Rodney Dangerfield. And it will be very interesting to watch from a science experiment perspective, but also in the sense that we find, as of 2 years ago, America starts to stood up for its interest and sort of bit back, and we'll see how this works.
Okay, interesting. He gave the president gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and he said essentially that he was ready to escalate the trade war with China. He said it was highly unlikely that a planned meeting with President Xi at the G20 summit would yield anything, and he was also prepared to hit Chinese goods on Chinese consumer goods with another $267 billion worth of tariffs, which would include consumer goods like the iPhone, which so far has been spared. So we're going down that road. So let me ask you this. For people that don't follow this as closely, what is the end state the United States is looking for? What's the in this? And I think you quite rightly identified, you know, the United States has identified this as the critical vulnerability. This is their center of gravity. When you hit at this, you are hitting into in maneuver warfare terms, the center of gravity of the Chinese. And so this is a serious form of warfare that's being played right now, and it's pretty interesting to watch. What's the end state that the United States is looking for?
A change in behavior by the Chinese government to away from this, stop seizing oceans, stop taking stuff that doesn't belong to them, stop subverting governments, discriminating against Western companies, stop stealing their technology, their business know-how, their trade secrets, stop limiting what they can invest in, stop cheating them. Ultimately, I think one of the tests is if can allow a contract to be enforced in China honestly, according to its terms, and not according to whatever President Xi or the Communist Party says the contract is. So really, they're trying to get a fundamental change in Chinese behavior. And I'm not optimistic about that,
right?
Because it's really the equivalent of if you have, say, a juvenile delinquent, who say he's 40-year-old juvenile delinquent because he's been allowed to be a juvenile delinquent. Nobody's ever challenged him on it. And then you finally confront him and say, look, you gotta act like a normal guy. He's been a juvenile delinquent for so long that how is he ever going to sort of behave honestly? And that's hard to see. I think the effort is to apply so much economic pressure on these juvenile delinquents that they either somehow do change or else they somehow just go away. Or lose the ability to cause trouble. They just suddenly go live under the highway somewhere. Then nobody likes to say it, but, you know, one wonders if it requires regime change in order to, improve China.
Holy shit.
The state is such a fundamental change in behavior that it's hard to see exactly how this will be done voluntarily, but certainly, I think you can at least present the Chinese Communist Party's leadership with some very hard choices to make. Either stop being so aggressive or bullying or threatening, or run the risk of just losing control of your entire economy, losing the confidence of these 1.3 billion people, and having to deal with widespread popular unrest. The Chinese internal security budget, keep in mind, is higher than their regular defense budget. It always has been. So they are sort of riding a tiger in a way, and if they can't keep the economic thing going, people are eventually going to blame the Chinese Communist Party for this. At the minimum, they're going to blame President Xi, who's got plenty of enemies,
right?
Even though he's been able to kill or imprison or sideline an awful lot of them. But that just makes him more. So this is, I think, about the best they can hope for in the Trump administration is keep the pressure on and present the Chinese Communist Party with some tough choices about how they're going to behave, either behave or, say, lose control of the economy and with all the good things that happen when the Chinese masses get angry. One thing to keep in mind is you'll hear it a lot in the reporting and in the Chinese side of things as well, is that China is promising more opening up, you know, market opening up and reforms. I have a friend who's been in, he's worked in China for a long time, starting in the 80s. And he said, you know, look, I was there, you know, for 30 plus years. And every quarter on the front pages of the Chinese papers, there would be talk about opening up and reforms every quarter, just regularly. So he says, I've been, was there for, you know, like 60 quarters, whatever it is. And every, and they always said the same thing. Nothing ever changed. And that is one way to look at all of this is China always says it's going to be opening up. It's going to protect intellectual property, which it says isn't under threat anyway.
Right.
But nothing changes. And unless this sort of economic pressure is continued and increased, you won't see this juvenile delinquent change their behavior. So we'll see. A lot depends on whether Mr. Trump is going to keep the pressure on, and ultimately whether the next administration in either 2 years or 6 years keeps the pressure on as well. So it's, you know, we're in like round one of a 15-round fight, and we'll see how this goes.
And but the story, as it's been historically written, is the United States has not had the wherewithal and the political leadership and wherewithal to bring the Chinese to the table to look across evenly. We always simply issue a strongly worded statement and give them their way.
Yes, that's pretty much what it's always been.
Okay.
From right. When Nixon showed up, practically. Now, we've in the Reagan era, they handed over torpedo technology, some advanced military technology to beef up the Chinese as a sort of counterweight to the Russians. The Carter administration did the same thing. They let them into WTO as in exchange for some nice bribes to Bill Clinton or Mrs. Clinton, and some other things. It's been 40 years of accommodation and appeasement, for want of a better word. And of course the Chinese love this predictability. I would too if I was playing poker with somebody and they were handing over their aces whenever they got them. I would not be inclined to tell them to play fair and square.
Right.
And it has been that bad. It's funny to hear the sort of Chinese officials, say the ambassador to the U.S., for example, complaining about how unpredictable the Trump administration is. Well, yeah, thank goodness. Considering that every administration before this was entirely predictable and entirely accommodating to Chinese interests in the belief that they would eventually become like us and become liberal Democrats or become like Canadians. This has changed. And I think the fact that guys like Hank Paulson, who used to run Goldman Sachs, and Robert Rubin, these guys don't seem to have any influence or much influence in this administration. Even Kissinger doesn't seem to have so much influence. That, I think, is throwing the Chinese for a loop. It's confused them because they've been so used to having their trusted intermediaries, who are very well paid, by the way, smooth things over in America. Tell the administrations you gotta help the Chinese out here. You gotta do them a favor. If things are moving in the right direction, you cannot confront them. These people have sold out the United States for many years and really have gotten very rich off of it. So this has finally changed. The Chinese are a little confused by it, and we'll see if America continues to be unpredictable or else becomes predictable in the sense that they're clearly opposing Chinese behavior and doing what's necessary to try to change it. Whether or not it's too late, I don't know, but I like to think the game is at least not over yet, but now maybe in the late innings.
It'll be interesting. America's standing up, to quote you, America's standing up on its hind legs, finally. Email. Mac, would you ask Grant is this significant to our allies as well? When they see the United States pushing back on China, not only in the South China Sea, but also economically, which we all know is more important. Brent?
Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, it's a good question. It's the right one to ask, and it's actually correct. The Europeans and the Japanese have both sort of quietly sided with the Americans in this effort to put pressure on China. They haven't fully, you know, they're still trying to have their cake and eat it too and do as much business as they can, but the Europeans have and the Japanese have resisted Chinese efforts to come out against the Americans, and in fact both Europe and Japan, the EU and Japan, have gone along with issued statements criticizing China, and also pointing out there hasn't been much change in Chinese behavior at all from a business perspective, and that they're not quite saying mad as hell and not going to take it anymore, and those, they don't do things that way. But they've certainly, say they have not not signed up with what the Chinese want them to do, and have sided with the Americans. I think they, doing it kind of quietly, but they're, I think, very thankful that Mr. Trump is taking this stance. Of course, both Europe and Japan, just like us, does have a sizable constituency of the people who would really sell their mothers for a bowl of pottage if there was money to be had in China. So they do have to deal with it. By and large, the allies, I think, are glad to see the Americans actually doing this, taking this approach towards China. And if that continues, it's a good thing. Particularly the case of Europe, some of the countries have publicly expressed their concerns over Chinese investment, and there's even the Germans have actually restricted it, made it harder for Chinese to invest in some German companies. Wow. So it has an overall effect of reducing the amount of greenbacks available to the Chinese government. But so the answer is yes, the allies are, by and large, I think, supportive of Mr. Trump, but they hate Mr. Trump, right, or at least the Europeans do, so much that they can't bring themselves to be too vocal about.
Right. Even though we may mimic his behavior in terms of policy and what we enact, we certainly cannot go there.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That was a good question.
Interesting. Mac, before you let Grant go, I'd be curious to get his observations on the latest chapter of Russia and the Ukraine. Grant, more of the same from Vladimir Putin in terms of kind of grabbing all your or a few hors d'oeuvres off your table, right? Spilling a drink and then walking away. Not so much to cause a full bar fight, enough to roil the bar and then to walk away. I'm just curious your thoughts on Vladimir Putin doing it again.
I think this is more serious than sort of nibbling at the edges on the ground in eastern Ukraine, where there's kind of a stalemate. I think shooting up the Ukrainian ships and seizing them and I think this is more serious. Is my take on it. I would like to see us really just cut off I'd exclude Russia from the world financial community, from the U.S. dollar system, and even introduce airline sanctions. I think this really needs to be hit hard. If it isn't, I see this as a really serious escalation of that particular conflict, with the knock-on effects as other thugs around the world see what works and what the West, the civilized world, does not do. I think this was going way beyond what's been done to date, was my sense in terms of an escalation. And maybe why Putin did it, I don't know. maybe he realizes the Westerners aren't going to do anything.
Right.
Well, the reaction do you
think,
to the...
Do you think that's the bet? The bet is, look, they won't do anything. They never do anything. Again, a strongly worded statement, I'll keep the ships. I'll continue to keep the Ukraine unsettled. Because the last thing I need the Ukraine to do is get stronger, its democratic roots get deeper. I don't need that right next to me, because there's so many people with ties in the Ukraine that have the family in Russia, 80% speak Russian. And the last thing I need is this kind of seeping into Russia that, you know what, life is better here, right? It's more open. You're more free. We're learning about capitalism. And although we struggled with it in the 90s, we're learning about it. And our lives are infinitely better. Russia doesn't need that. Putin doesn't need that. And so to me, the continued destabilization of that is important. I'm curious. So the gambit is, once again, no response from the United States, or a verbal response from the United States, NATO, and the EU, and then it's over, and he continues to do what he does.
I think that's his calculation. When you start shooting up ships and killing people, I don't know if he killed anyone, but shooting people like this and interrupting, really, this is how should you call it? It's kind of the Russian equivalent of seizing international waters. This is pretty bad, I think. There's no doubt plenty of people in Washington and throughout Europe and the ruling class level who are eager to figure out why this isn't so serious, but I think it is. But I think you've described what it derives from is this resentment over the breakup of the Soviet Empire many, many years ago, and also Ukraine, which had, I think Putin looks at as a key part of the Soviet Union, sort of drifting towards the West. And then when the sort of a pro-Putin thug who got turned out of office a few years ago, that just got Putin even angrier. And now you have, say, the allies conducting pretty big exercises up north in Norway, Finland, etc. I think Putin doesn't like that, and he's tried to interfere with those. And I think it's really an effort to not just keep the pressure on the West, but to up the ante and show that he's willing to do more than the West is willing to do. But we'll see. It'd be nice to see the British actually send these Russian oligarchs home without their money. I don't expect that to happen, but it'd be nice if it did. Send them home, revoke their residence permits, seize their bank accounts and send them home and, let them talk to Mr. Putin about this. But
there's been multiple, attacks on individuals inside the UK with chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, right? And chemical weapons. And if that doesn't get you your ass sent home and your bank account confiscated, I'm not sure how do you do?
I don't either, but the British successive British administrations, Labour and Conservative, over the last 20 years have, with open arms, probably 25 years, welcomed in Russian oligarchs who bring nothing but stolen money, dirty money with them, and they come in and they behave like oligarchs do. And this has been a conscious, willing decision by British administrations to let in the most unsavory people with their stolen money that has turned Russia into this giant kleptocracy when there was a little bit of optimism for it. But the British have welcomed them because they brought all this money, which allowed the City of London financial institutions to prosper, and politicians get paid off, etc. And it's underreported, but I would put Britain into the Google class when it comes to sort of just amorality in this particular case, but it's part of the dynamic. If that, you know, if Putin can't deliver the goods for those co-conspirators, that potentially is a problem for him. But we've decided not to really put pressure on Russia from that angle, for whatever reason.
All right, final question. What are you writing on next?
Oh, boy. I think I have to do something about, I do another take on the Carlos Ghosn, the Nissan thing, for another outlet. So I try to add some different angles, particularly the defense ramifications. And then something, I've been trying to do something about trade, the Chinese trade dispute. And really, the answering that question you asked is, where is it going to end? But I haven't gotten around to it. I've only been at it for 5 weeks. But the economic stuff, you really have to, you know, it's, you have to have your ideas in order and make sure they're right. Cause, and it's not really my specialty, so I have to be, it seems to take me a little longer. But I was able to sort of talk myself through an article, this talking to you, so I have some ideas of how to structure it. And I think I might even be able to get in Jefferson Davis's name.
I love that.
Into these 850 words.
And you know, we always love to contribute, so we're very, very, that's very good.
Never have an original idea. My problem.
Well, you know what? It's the inspiration of others that, as well as a bit of an original thought that I think tends to make most of us, produce things. So anyway, well, Grant, first of all, it's wonderful catching up with you, and always loved that having you on and the interesting discussion. I like you though. I mean, I've learned so much from having you on the program, but I am encouraged by his behavior is insufferable, right? And some of the things he does. But I will tell you this, his policy relative to China is the policy that the nation needs in the long term, right? And I think he's got that right. What he's done with NATO is the appropriate policy. What he's done in the South China Sea, appropriate policy. And so I think we're getting big pieces right. But the politics is pretty painful to watch. And I always appreciate your commentary and the way you educate. So thank you very much.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Anytime. I'm always amazed that anybody's listening at work, because I'm always on like at 1 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning. So I'm always surprised. I think everyone else must be sleeping except for me and you. Surprised anybody listens. But
they're not. And the beautiful thing about it is, our numbers keep growing. So, over 500,000 downloads in the last 15 months. So exciting stuff. So keep growing. Yeah. Very good. Very good. And you're a part. And again, people that tell the truth are what people find here. And I think it's wonderful. And you're one of those people that tell the truth and make it smart. So thank you very much.
Sure. Okay. Anytime. Well, thanks a lot. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks, Grant. Grant Newsham here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio. We're going to talk to the gunner about hazing. Yeah, when we come back. When, you know, that's a subject, big article. I already talked about it in Marine Corps Times today. And written about a mutual friend of ours. So I'm going to ask Gunner what he would do, right? He's of the Pinepalian tribe, and that means he came in as an enlisted Marine, came up to the rank of gunnery sergeant, transitioned, became warrant officer, Marine gunner, rank of warrant officer, and then rose to become WO5. And so he has this very unique place in the Marine Corps, kind of straddles two communities. And is in a third. So we're going to get his solution to the hazing thing. If he were queen for a day. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SimplifyFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.